おめ
え薄いのアホ。
ムーンプリズムタワーメイクアップロカードレディーに
しておいてね。欲望は心に隠しておきたいの本当は秘密秘密。
Welcome to Shoujo and Tell, where we discuss shoujo manga and tell who's hot and who's not, talk about themes, and just generally geek out. Today, June 16th, 2018, we'll be shoujo and telling about the second half of the series, Princess Jellyfish, by Akiko Higashimura. That's volumes 9 to 17 and volumes 5 to 9 in English. It's confusing, whatever. I'm your host, Ashley McDonald, and I'm joined once again by Carrie McLean. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, do you want to go over who you are again in case somebody only cares about the second half of Princess Jellyfish for some reason?
That's fine. You should care about both. So, hey, everybody. My name is Carrie McLean. I am a writer, and editor, and reviewer based in the greater Los Angeles area. Again, my love affair began with Sailor Moon a long time ago, back in my middle school days. And I just kind of gravitated to Josei manga because I'm a child who grew up and wanted to see, you know, older representations of girls and women. And it just all worked out. And we're here.
Yes. And so Carrie is the, like, longtime Princess Jellyfish super fan. And I'm the newly converted Princess Jellyfish super fan, right? Okay.
One of us.
That's right. And just as a reminder to people, Princess Jellyfish is available from Kodansha USA. The last volume came out on June 5th, so we're releasing this, like, it'll come out, like, 2 months after, so hopefully you've had enough time to finish it all, because we're definitely going to spoil everything, so yay, prepare yourselves. Yeah, do you want to give a quick plot recap of things that are specific to the volumes that we read?
All right, so, again, Princess Jellyfish is kind of like a slice of life Josei manga about a bunch of otaku women living in a women's-only apartment complex, which is kind of retro and not quite run down. They kind of come in contact with Kirinosuke, who's this beautiful girl dressing in drag. So he's actually a guy dressed up as a girl. And it just sets off this wonderful chain of events of how, hey, gentrification is happening. Big companies want to buy up the area and kick them out of their home. They want to fight and keep their home. Hey, let's make dresses. So Kimi gets proposed to. So much happens. She goes to Singapore. The ball, everything kind of just starts changing rapidly when the Amars, the girls, the women, young women in the apartment complex fight to find a way to save their home and get the money and the funds secured. And we have all these eccentric, wonderful characters that join the cast. And it's such a fun ride. There you go.
Yeah. This is the, like, things get real arc. Like, Kurinosuke is like, oh, building a business is actually hard. Wow. Okay, we have to all work. Wow, it's amazing.
I can't just sit and look pretty, you know?
I know.
No,
yeah,
you can't.
It doesn't work that way. Wow, amazing. And you had warned me in the first episode that I should be prepared to cry, so I figured that we should discuss which moments made us actually cry, because I did cry.
Well, on you know, we go from scale to, like, 0 to 100, 1 to 10. From, like, the very bottom scale, I would kind of tear up with the frustration mounting for the Amars, right? Like, every step of the way of them moving one step forward, three steps back, they were just getting, like, pounded with, like, failure and setbacks. And it was really frustrating because they're really trying. And if you see yourself in any of the Amars, in Tsukimi, Banba, Gigi, if you feel like an outsider or a marginalized person in any kind of way, that kind of chips at you, like, yo, I feel that. I feel like you're trying to do your best and your best isn't good enough on a very small scale. So, like, 1, 2, 3. But then getting up there to the higher numbers, you had remarked anything involving Kirinosuke's mom. And I'm like, oh, God.
Yes. No, when she told Shu, she was like, tell whoever the girl is in Kirinosuke's life to love him lots and lots. Because I couldn't. I was just like, I'm stopping. Stop it. This is no good. Yeah,
so let me just put a small bookmark there. So Shu takes a few days off, takes some vacation time, which he's probably never taken. says the guy who put all his, like, New Year's Day savings into a bank account since he was in middle school. And he has, like, millions of yen or whatnot. this guy takes a vacation day off, takes some vacation day, so like a weekend. He goes to Kurenosuke's mother, Lina or Linda, and she's in Italy, Paris?
She's in Italy, yeah.
Yeah, so she's overseas. She wanted a dress that her son helped make. So he's bringing that to her, but he also wants advice because he wants to buy Tsukimi an engagement ring. Oh my God. Right? Like, shoe. That's such a shoe thing, right? And when they're parting, when Shu's leaving, she's like, thank you so much, you know, for bringing me the dress. Because she's, you know, she didn't get a chance to raise her son, but she's like, yo, you know, she's asking about her son. And she's like, yo, you know, tell whoever Kurenosuke loves, love him for what I couldn't do. Like, what to make up for what I and this,
I know. And it hurts more because you know that Shu is basically stealing Kurenosuke's girl at this point. And you're like, stop it, Shu. You know in your heart that you're doing this.
You like, you know that this, you're part of a love hexagon or triangle or that. I know shapes, but I don't know them right now. So you know you're a part of this.
Yeah. Yeah, my low level, like, tearing up was just seeing Kurenosuke be frustrated about, like, everybody taking Tsukimi away from him, basically, and, you know, not being able to see his mom, and him, like, yelling at Chu in a convenience store, and she was like, why are you shouting at me right now? And I'm like, you deserve it, Chu.
You deserve it. Yeah, Kurenosuke has this really, I'd say, odd relationship with his family. So he lives with his father, technically, I guess, his stepmother, and his half-brother, Shu. So he's been living without, you know, his mom. And he's kind of just, I mean, a little bit later in his origin story, he's like, yeah, I've graduated from high school. I've done the thing. I'm going to college. And I don't want to be Shu, and I don't want to be this. And, you know, he's looking for something more. And so I guess at this point of the series, I guess his second half, he has not come to the realization that he's in love with Tsukimi. But he's come to the point where he's like, look, she belongs here and I'm here. So I'm in the circle of here. So this is where she's supposed to be. And it's him not understanding his feelings.
I think he understands them, but he had consciously chosen to give up on them. Like, he has the whole thing where he's like, oh, I'm the fairy godmother here. Like, I transformed Tsukimi into a princess for another prince. So, okay, fine. I'm going to accept that role. But he, like, clearly does not. He's just like, I'm the most important person to Tsukimi. Me. You all hop off.
Yeah, it's like, I was like, at first I was like, I don't know if he's just not acknowledging his feelings. But yeah, it's more like he's kind of like,
He's like, I don't want to acknowledge my own feelings. I'm trying really hard to help all of you out, but y'all piss me off frequently.
Y'all piss me off. In the first half of the series, I'm like punching walls like, oh my God, she's so cute. She's creepy because she's smiling at a jellyfish in a tank. And now he's kind of like, I've had it to hear with all of you.
Yeah, he's like, y'all about to push me to this breaking point, but I'm gonna figure it out. Look, Tsukimi is like giving herself up for me. Oh no, that's not what I want though.
Yeah, it's so much going on. Like the author did a real good job of like upping the ante, you know, here. Like it just, the stakes get higher and higher. It's like, oh, not just we won't have a place, but Tsukimi is gone, right? She sacrificed herself. So that's a wonderful segue into the newer characters in these newer volumes and some of those big overarching themes.
Yeah. As soon as Kai and Fae-yeon showed up, I was like, I'm not going to like this. This is going to be bad. But would you like to explain who they are?
Sure. Such fascinating characters. I think Kai is meant to be like the villain. I don't think he's the villain in this story. So when the Amars and Kurenosuke, they do an exhibit at like a little fashion hall with their newer dresses that they've like hand dyed and worked on and a lot of work. Like the venomous poisonous jellyfish, really cool concept.
I know, that was good.
Yeah, so they run into Kai Fish, who is like, I don't know, the Kevin Klein of Asia. He's like this really hotshot young fashion designer with this new company that is pretty much like the prince of fashion of the Asian continents. And he's just a really significant person in the fashion industry. And Tsukimi and Amars have no idea who he is. He stumbles upon their dresses and he is super intrigued in the concepts and the dresses. And of course, more importantly, Tsukimi, because she is the designer. Fae-yong is someone he grew up with and someone who works under him. kind of a secretary person. But pretty much she's running the whole show because he runs off and does things.
He's too busy sleeping with models and whatever. Yeah.
He's kind of an eccentric character. Like, he'll go off and like get curry and just like go swimming. And
yeah, he's eating lots of fish curry. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So Fei Young, Kai. Any other characters that are really important that we should talk about in the second half?
I mean, no. It's just a lot of like, okay, you don't think that Kai is the villain here. I kind of think that's because there's no true villain in this series. But
thank you.
Yeah. So, I mean, his story in the end gets like totally flipped around.
Yes.
And be sad.
Fascinating. There's no true villain in this story. And like, because the characters are like multi-layered or three-dimensional, like, I really appreciate that. Because, you know, in a lot of stories and narratives, like, oh, this is the villain, like clean cut. And I'm like, ah! Or is this like a Marvel Cinematic Universe villain? It's like, oh, he's totally like crazy.
Yeah, he's just crazy bad guy, right? Yeah.
It's like, but he had a really hard life. It's like, okay, yeah. I was like, no, but he was stolen. Oh, okay. Gotcha. So these characters are like sympathetic, right? To a certain extent. Like you read about them, you're like, wow, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And on the topic of like upping the ante, I liked it because I felt like the ante was certainly upped and there were still like, you know, crazy like rich people hijinks of like, well, we just stole her to Singapore. Like, that makes sense. You can just do that or whatever. But it never felt like just really crazy, like out there, like that doesn't make any sense. Upping the ante, it was like, okay, you've stayed within some realm of actual believability for me that normally happen. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I guess when we think about the overarching themes, clothes being really important, like we briefly touched upon this, but last time I was like, clothes become even more important with the second half with the introduction of Kai and Fei Young and whatnot.
Yeah, we got some serious like lessons in clothes this time, like rants about like what's the difference between knit and weave and like all these things. I was like, oh,
and
God.
Jersey. I'm just like, look, if you read the entirety of Princess Jellyfish for the listeners, you will learn like five things at least that will stick with you about fashion and clothes. And the fashion industry, I'm just like, okay. Yeah. I mean, you learn something. You learn something.
Yeah. We can all go start clothing companies now, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the relationship with clothes and the different characters, it all goes a certain kind of way. So with Kai and Fei Young, it's where the clothes can take you. So they've gone from poverty to extreme wealth and prestige and fame and whatnot, because they were both in an orphanage. And, you know, now Kai is the head of one of the biggest clothing companies ever in Asia that reaches out like almost everywhere. With Kiranosuke, you can take this one. Clothes were a connection with his mother.
Yeah, he's always just like had dresses in his room and all these things. And I guess he's always been a pretty boy. So like he was always semi-fashionable. But then like, you know, and thinking about how he doesn't want to be a politician and all these things, he started cross-dressing and it just became like, well, you know, I can look more and more like my mother and this can be my connection to her. And, you know, in starting a clothing company, there's when Chu takes the dress to Lena. Lena asks Chu, like, oh, does Kuranosuke want to be a designer? And she was like, no, he totally just like made this dress for you. Like that's Chu's concept of what has happened here. And I'm just like, Chu. On some level, that's true. Chu. But like Chu glasses, sure.
Yeah, just Chu. I said, what can you do about him?
Oh, Chu.
Like his heart is in the right place.
He's trying hard. He's oblivious. He can't recognize Kimi when she's not in drab clothes or whatever.
We are going to get into that because it's like, you got to recognize her. So yeah, with Kiranosuke, what clothes, the connection of what clothes mean to him, connection with his mother. And he was, it's clothes are somewhat like a part of his identity. When his little origin story later, and he's like, oh, you know, I finished high school and I'm in college and I don't want to be a politician like Chu. And Chu was the golden boy. And he's like, I don't want to be like Chu and wear a drab gray suit every day. It was like, even then.
He's like, I know what I definitely don't want to be wearing.
Right.
Drab suits.
I just love how clothes is like a part of his identity, like his DNA. And it's also like when he thinks about his future, And he's a young person. He's like 20. He's like, I don't, whatever happens in my future, I want to be dressed nicely. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's a funny tidbit. I was like, okay, okay. And the Amars, Tsukimi and her friends, her roommates in the apartment complex, clothes become the means to save their home. Like some clothes are something they never really thought about. And they're like, yo, this is one way to save the day, hopefully. They despair a lot. They're like, nah, maybe not. But yeah, this becomes a means to like save the day, get the money, dollar bills, y'all, and do the thing. And to connect with Kiranosuke earlier, what you were saying, for his mother, clothes help bring closure in a way, yeah?
Yeah, for like, you know, she...
For her.
Yeah, she hadn't been singing for a while, and then she wanted this dress, you know, because she was doing a very small event, and she sang in the dress, and then at the end, she obviously gets to see Kuranosuke when they're doing another fashion show, and gives him a suit, so it all goes around. And they are brought back together, and I'm like, yo, Kuranosuke is crying, oh no.
That was the one thing I didn't know what we would get, and I was like, thank you. I didn't know I needed that. Thank you. Yeah. I was like, oh, I mean, tears. And then I guess on a more grand scale, Tsukimi realized when she's studying about fashion, so she has to wait like a week or two, or her passport is being prepared and finalized in Japan, so she gets whisked away to, you know, luxury hotels in Japan, and she's with the home base of Kai's company, the Japanese home base where all his designers, the Japanese designers and workers are at. And she's rigorously studying about fashion and clothes and the industry. And she realizes that while she's studying, that clothes can give you experience, right? And she's like, I like that. And she starts daydreaming and thinking of stuff. But when we think in real life, we buy certain clothes for weddings and like for graduation and or, you know, what have you, you know. And then clothes in the real life, but also, I guess, in the realm of manga, especially this manga, clothes help define and redefine your role in society. So we think, hey, police officers have uniforms and firefighters, janitors usually, security guards, but like if you kind of just sit and think, everyone has a uniform for something. Even if you work like at Walmart or Target, you have like a red shirt or a blue shirt or something with the company logo. And I mentioned even school uniforms, and you mentioned in Japan, this is much more true than America.
Because I feel like there is a very, you know, Japanese take on clothes here. Like with Kai's company, they're like, well, for Japan, they don't like flashy things, right? Basically, even though they have, you know, this part of the story is based in Harajuku, which is supposed to be known for like weird fashion trends.
Outlandish fashion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but like overall, Japanese, they're like, we don't want to stand out. They're very like collective society, like community based. So they like, in the way that America is all like, we're individuals, we fight for our individuality. It's like, Japan's like, no. Like community is the thing that you have to fight for, and like don't stand out and all these things. So Kai's company basically makes fancy, like the fanciest clothes are just like black and white and monotone colors and all these things. But yeah, just like in Japan, I mean, it's also, it makes sense why, you know, all the Amars aren't really super fashionable because, yeah, they all wear school uniforms. Like, it's not like in America where it's like public schools don't have uniforms and like all these things. So you are just assigned school uniforms forever. And like, it's fun to walk around Japan and have like five like security guards at construction sites who are supposed to like guide pedestrians, and they're all like wearing the same uniform, but they all look so dapper and everything. It's just like, how, Japan? Like, what? Why does everybody have a uniform for everything?
For everything. That's pretty interesting. I hadn't thought about it in the Japanese sense, but no, that's a terribly accurate observation.
Yeah.
And even going back into the manga, for Kai's company, the people who work for him, they dress a certain way usually. So people are wearing that crisp white shirt with the collar and the buttons. So the crisp white button down, I guess, which comes into play later with his origin story. And it's just that's a standalone. Like if Kai's origin story was like a short and like a manga contest, like that would win. Really had a lot of depth to me. And it was interesting, but it was really like, it really flipped the tables. It was like, oh.
Yeah, there definitely was like writing notes for that chapter. I was like, I feel like I just wrote an essay just on this one chapter, like partially just because so much happened, but it was still like comprehensible and good and everything. I was like, oh, okay.
Interesting. Just fantastic writing, like world building, yeah, but it's fantastic character development and writing. This manga, this is really top 10 manga for me. I'm just like, this, a lot of love went in, and thought and care went into this manga, and it shows. It really does. I really appreciate that. Mm.
Yeah. And then overall, my feelings about clothes and how all the characters relate to it was that, like, you know, we have the saying that, like, clothes make the man. And many characters acknowledge that. Like, I think that's Kai's whole thing, is that he's like, well, because his backstory is about, he was like, I just wear the same t-shirt every day and it's fine. And then some other kid went and found a crisp white shirt, button-down shirt, in somebody's trash at the orphanage. And they were all like, that's sad and pathetic or whatever. You, like, stole somebody's trash. And he's like, well, if it's trash, they didn't want it, so I didn't steal it. Calm down or whatever.
Yeah.
And then even though he's not, you know, he's like a little chubby and everything, so I think people don't expect it to make a difference. But then he gets adopted because he looks like the most put together of the children.
Yes. Presentation is everything.
Right. Goodness. Yeah. So then Kai obviously, you know, thinks he's, for him, he's like, yes, clothes make the people. And I think that he went into the clothing business as a way, like, it's purely a way to make money and, like, exploit this thing in society. Like, I don't think he inherently cares about clothes. He's just kind of like, well, you need clothes and clothes do this, so I can capitalize on that, right?
Clothes can elevate your position in society, help you change, you know, help you get up into different classes, you know, better your life.
Yeah, like, he's still after that. Like, he doesn't go and wear the clothes. Like, he has this whole money scheming thing where he goes and steals everybody's trash that he can find that has clothes in it from rich people, and he then sells it at, like, their community auction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, their bazaars or whatever. And he doesn't seemingly ever try to take clothes because he still wears the same t-shirt. He's just like, whatever, I'm just gonna make money off of this and then someday be a rich boy who can manipulate all of you. Whereas I feel like, you know, the thing with Kurenosuke and the Amars is that they're like, no. We don't, clothes don't make us, like, we make the clothes that we want to make us, right?
Yes. So, like, yes.
We are making jellyfish at the end. By the end, they're making jellyfish dresses for them. And they are definitely a thing. Like, they want them to be practical and be able to change. Like, they've realized that jellyfish don't have a one set thing that they are throughout their whole life. So they're like, okay, jellyfish metamorphize or whatever. So we're going to make things that can be like five different outfits, really, with complicated zippers and whatever.
How cool was that? That was such a cool couple of, I want to say scene, I'm thinking movie. That was such a cool couple of pages, panels. I was like, oh, they really thought this out.
I know. I was like, wow, Higashimura is like taking a real risk. Cause I feel like, you know, if you're not actually in fashion and then you're like, I'm going to make all these cool designs, it would just come off as like silly. But I think she actually pulled it off. And she did explain in one of the bonus manga that she had been like making clothes, her own clothes since high school or whatever for a while. And yeah, it reminded me, I'm like, I definitely have some clothes where I'm like, yeah, this is supposed to function as 50 million different things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, those things work to varying degrees in real life, but whatever, this is manga, we're allowed to do whatever.
We're allowed to do whatever in the realm of, there's still an ounce of believability here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like those could be real clothes. Whether you find them annoying is like a different problem. But like,
I would wear some of that stuff. I'd be like, shh, you guys have a size, whatever.
Yeah.
I'd wear that. Be like, yo, this is me.
This is me. Yeah. So they, like, yeah, because what they discover is that the Amars get frustrated with clothes because they're like, well, you need different clothes to like go to work and then like go to the gym and then just like hang out at your house, and like that's too much effort, so why bother? And I'm like, I agree with you, Amars. That's perfectly fine. So they are like now making clothes because they have passion and all these things, which is certainly something that Kai was trying to find by stealing Tsukimi. is what we learn eventually. Because, you know, Sukimi keeps looking at his designs and she's like, I don't, like, the dresses that I've made don't...
The clothes are empty. Yeah, she's like, the clothes are empty. Like, the dress that she sees the model Kiki in on the big billboard, she keeps seeing it. She's like, the dress is empty.
Yeah.
That's a very weird, that's very, like, child, like, very basic childlike observation to make, like, in the words.
Yeah. But no, it was powerful when she asked Kuranosuke, like, hey, Kuranosuke, is this, like, fashionable? Like, can you, is this stylish? Can you tell me? And he's just like... no, Sukimi, you're right. It's empty. Like,
yeah,
whatever. but yeah, so Kai had been trying to, like, actually find passion for clothes again, or, like, ever, I guess, yeah, with Sukimi, because her designs were not like his. But you see that Kai has, like, sucked the soul out of all of his employees, too. Like, he has that one guy who's like, yeah, whoa, yeah, you have feelings about that?
I do, but I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry. I was just my involuntary, like, yo, yeah.
Yo, yes. And yeah, like, there's the one dude. So she basically interacts with two people. I think one of them is named Io, who is the one who's, like, really, really, really cynical and is like, I started a fashion brand initially with my friends, but, like, nobody bought those designs. And then, like, I cut them off and now work for Kai and, like, whatever, just fashion is a game. And, like, I'm just here to make money. And then there's the, like, flamboyant dude that she's initially with, who's very frustrated that she doesn't know anything. Yeah. But yeah, he's like, there's a moment where Sukimi is being like, oh, so are all these clothes really, really highly priced because it's fashionable, plus you're selling people, like, the dreams of what they want to be? And he's like, no, fool, it's for the cost of labor and shipping and warehouses.
She's so realistic and naive. It's adorable. Like, you can't help but love Sukimi.
I know.
It's adorable. He's like, no, real life. You know what I mean? It's the price of labor and cloth. And
yeah. But in the end, you're kind of like, no, but Sukimi's also right. Like, what you're selling them is aspirational self, right? Like, that's basically part of it. But yeah, so, like, the way that they all see it is very sad and cynical. Sukimi is supposed to bring new life to them. But yeah, so, like, it's just like the Amaras now have taken control of themselves and they will not let clothes define who they are to society. They will make the clothes that then define them to society that they have made. Yeah. So they have just defined themselves all the way around.
Like, it's levels to this. It really is. I've really enjoyed that realization. Like, it had been a long time coming, but the realization, like, hey, we make the clothes we want to see in the world. You make the change you want to see in the world. But what really was a striking thing when Sukimi was doing, she was, you know, with Kai's company and studying and being strung along and everything. Kai did bring her because he's like, oh, she's a designer. I like her new ideas. And he's like, oh, he was describing her to Kiki. He's like, Kiki is like the model. Mm. The really, sorry, oh, I can't stand Kiki. She was like, oh, who is this? And Kai's like, oh, she's a designer. She'll change the world with her, you know, the joke. Oh, my goodness. Like, for everyone who can see Sukimi for who she is, I appreciate them. You know, it takes a fine eye. But Sukimi was, you know, with Kai's folks. And the one worker you mentioned earlier, then you said, I know? He had glasses. And he would wear the uniform of the white shirt and the, I guess, the black slacks or whatever. He did say, hey, I started off with making clothes with my friends. I had these very avant-garde suits, fabric no one would wear. And it was fun. But like many businesses and fashion folks, it didn't pan out. I started working for Kai. He's like, I don't know why I'm still doing this. Like, this isn't, I don't have my friends anymore. This isn't fun. I don't have my previous love and passion for this anymore, which was eye-opening because when he starts talking to Sukimi, she's like, oh, I didn't make this. I made this with my friends. And it's not fun anymore, right? Like, it's just a job. It's just a paycheck for someone else's vision, which isn't even, it's stagnant. It's not even what it could be or what it should be. Even when she's finally leaving to go to Singapore, the passport has been finalized. He's like, Sukimi, get her to a TV. And it's her friends on the televised protest. They're kind of just taking advantage. And they're all in jellyfish dresses. And he was so excited, right? This is the most excited I've ever seen him in the manga.
Oh, yeah, definitely. He was like, look, you've proven to me that friends do matter, sort of thing. Like, your friends do care about you.
Like, she wants to come home. And she's like, I want to come home and make jellyfish dresses with the MRs. Like, there's that very specific, I want to be home with the people I know and love making dresses. I don't want to do this alone. Like, it's very lonely at the top.
Yeah, and Kai's company is just, like, full of dysfunction. Like, Fayon also eventually leaves because she's just like, I'm so disgusted with you, Kai. Like, you get implications throughout that they used to be, like, a couple, and now he's, you know, sleeping with everybody, like, kisses Sukimi, all these things. It kind of felt like that was the one true thing in Kai's life, and he messed that up, so then eventually she leaves him and is like, whatever, I'm going back to the orphanage and just working here where, you know, we used to actually like care about things. And
yeah, like when we were kids, we were on a struggle bus trying to make a better life for ourselves. Oof, yeah, that was tough.
Yeah, and I guess the one last thing I had about clothes was that the metaphor of Kurenosuke being like, you need to don your armor to go out. And it's like, it does go both ways where it's like, okay, yeah, he's acknowledging that it's like, I know you don't like this, but like to get around in society, you need to dress fancy sometimes or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in the end, Kurenosuke is also very aware that like there is some sort of true self that like no matter how you dress it up, you cannot disguise in any way. And I like donning your armor is just a way to defend that true self that's inside of you. Like, you know, because they're trying to literally defend Amamizukan from getting destroyed mm-hmm. by the developers, but they are also trying to defend their lifestyle and being able to hide out in Amamizukan and not care what society thinks about their weird otakuness and all these things. Mm-hmm. And Kurenosuke also, you know, rants the epic rant at Shu about like, hey, you let Tsukimi get by you when I left you alone for like
God
30 minutes to like try to stalk Tsukimi so that she wouldn't go to Singapore or whatever. And he's like, and you let her get by you. And then he's like, well, they must have put her in a disguise and all these things. And she's like, yes, she was disguised, so I didn't recognize her. And Kurenosuke is like, fool, that's not an excuse. Don't you love her? Like, you should recognize her even if she's in a wig or has a bunch of makeup and all these things. He's like, there's still Tsukimi. What's wrong with you?
No, sincerely, it's like, this is the woman you love. You should be able to recognize her now, today, in cosplay, 40 years from now, and she's an old woman. It's like, who are you? Get it together, Shu. Get it together.
Shu. I love you, but also stop being so Shu.
I mean, like, it's a sincere move. It's like, Shu.
Yeah, and so what I like in the end is that, you know, it acknowledges that people can change, like the Amars can put on fancy clothes and be fine with it in the end, but like their transformation is kind of like really, really quiet. Like Mayaya is still like crazy into Three Kingdoms. Like you can't put on a fancy dress and think that that's like their hobbies don't change. They're not like, I am now a fashion otaku or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm. I just want to say, you know, transformations are not always physical. They, on the surface, they do work under the skin, you know, within or whatnot. This manga's kind of played up how clothes change the women and how the Amars don't want to be changed. And that's true, like, in certain circumstances. Like, you can change if you, I don't know, win the lottery and you have so many zeros in your bank account. It happens. People lose focus of who they are and their morals or whatnot, but
they become Kai, yes.
Yeah, which is, like, unfortunate. But transformations start within. And, I mean, in the end, the Amars start making clothes for themselves. And that itself is revolutionary, you know, that think that you yourself are worthy and valid and deserve nice things because there's other jellyfish girls. What I always liked about the Amars is that on the physical surface, that they're all different body types. Like no one is quite model thin or the model type, with the exception of Mayaya, because Kurenosuke is like, look, you have the look. And she's like, no, I don't. So that's
debatable.
She's
like, don't lie to me, Kurenosuke.
Because even he brought that up. He's like, look, girls would kill for your figure. And the Amar who's always in kimonos, Chico?
Yeah,
she's like, you know what? Chubby people would like kill you for something like that. Like, so like, I love how the Amars are always different body types and everything, because it's reflective of realistic standards for women. Like, we're all, no one is a size two, really, realistically, you know?
Yeah, and that's a good point about how, you know, the transformation is really that they realize that they can wear those dresses at all. Because the whole time that they're making dresses, the whole conflict is that they're like, well, why are we making these dresses when we cannot wear them? And Kurenosuke is like, No, but you can wear them though. Like I can, we can work on that. Like, you know,
that was a curveball for him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then they're like, okay, like, I guess. But then in the end, they're like, no, okay. Kurenosuke like sat us down and was like, what do you want out of clothes? I'm gonna make these clothes for you.
Oh yeah. That was a fun scene. They're like, yo, it has to be, you know, machine washable.
Yeah.
It has to be this. Right? And I'm like, yo, like, tell him what you want.
Yeah. And then in the end, they have the kind of, like, they all do the fashion show and they're like, you know what? This is fun. We don't live in an entirely different world from stylish. We're all in the same world or whatever. It's fine.
It's really, I felt like in the end, the fashion show was them integrating into society. Kind of like their debutante or their like homecoming. Like, yeah, like we can function and navigate to some extent on our own, you know, level to what we want to do into society. And I just really love that. I guess some people might brush it off because like, well, they're in a fashion show and they're wearing dresses and it's not. But yeah, like they're entering society or re-entering society. Like we can function too on our own terms. Right before Kai and Tsukimi and crew left for Singapore, it was something really interesting. Kai said, the instant a woman touches reality, she begins a beautiful transformation. Out of context, you'd be like, what? But he's talking about Tsukimi. He's like, look, he was talking to Kiki when she first inquired about Tsukimi. She's like, who are you bringing? A new model, designer? And he's like, yo, she's going to have beautiful experiences and meet beautiful people and learn different things. And when Tsukimi kind of comes to a realization of what she can do and who she is, that's going to motivate her to have agency and change the world, which she's been hinting at and everything for a minute. I guess last thing about transformation, the theme of transformation period is really significant in shoujo manga and anime, because usually in shoujo manga and anime, one big genre or subgenre is the magical girl genre.
Yes.
The girls are always transforming to something or someone. And then I guess another big subgenre of shoujo is like the high school age or the high school and the school days or whatnot. And
yeah,
those girls are, you know, growing up and learning about love and school and career, or what have you. So there's a lot of transformation in Princess Jellyfish, although a Jose manga, but it is, of course, shoujo at the heart. So it's I guess transformation, like the big physical transformation, is less realistic in Jose manga because there's not a lot of magical girls and stuff. But yeah, it's always like really subtle. Like in Jose manga, the woman character might get a makeover. But also a more subtle transformation, she might stop messing with a guy who's married or like, right, there's something changing under. So I guess, yeah, it's a much more subtle theme in Jose manga. But here, because it's closed, because it's really young women, right?
Yeah.
Who are kind of relearning things, trying to, you know, be a part of society. It works. It really works. I'm really just really impressed with where the storyline is taken off to. Bravo.
Bravo. Round of applause.
I'm done rambling. Bravo.
I agree, especially since, like, you know, Higashimura talks a lot in the bonus manga about being inspired by shoujo manga and all these tropes. And it's like, yeah, we've seen all these tropes before, but not executed to this level of perfection, I suppose.
Yeah.
In most things. Yeah.
It's some good work. Fine work by her.
Oh, Higashimura, how do you understand us all so well?
Mm-hmm.
Going back to, we're combining transformation and clothing. I forgot to point out the gender aspect of it. how could I forget? Kurenosuke is a crossdresser. I don't know. I get flustered sometimes.
Yep.
But I think that, you know, all this talk of transformation and the power of clothing also just goes so nicely with Kurenosuke's cross-dressing, which wasn't even supposed to be a thing initially, according to Higashimura. Like, she did it initially where they were all girls, and then her editor was like, what if this one is a cross-dressing boy? And she's like, yeah, we can do that, or whatever. But, you know, Kurenosuke's existence just shows that, like, gender is, of course, fluid and all these things. Mm-hmm. Like, you make gender. Gender does not make you. Yay.
Totally. Like gender, like sexuality, like a lot of things are fluid and, you know, it changes. that's a superb point to make, because it really helps explain his character, how I touched upon in the first our first podcast, how he can explore his femininity, right? Mm-hmm. The Amars are kind of like shook because they're like, he knows more about women than we do, right? And he's in fact a man and they are women. He's like, how do you guys not know this? Do you guys never go out for tea? Or they're like, no, who are you?
Who are you? We don't go outside.
Right? Totally.
Yeah. And like Kurenosuke is very interesting because he always identifies as male. Like he doesn't question that. I've definitely read some things from other people being kind of disappointed that he sort of perhaps looks down on Okama. Like he refuses to be identified as an Okama.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of like, I don't know if he's so much looking down on Okama so much as he does not want to identify that way. Like, I think he's like, oh, if you are an Okama, that's fine. Like, you know, I would hope that's what his response would be anyway.
But that's not me.
Yeah. Like, but that's, he just like doesn't care about labels. He's like, whatever. I just like to put on girl clothes sometimes. Like, calm down, everybody. And I think that's fine. As long as you respect other people's identities, it shouldn't really matter.
I don't see the problematic aspect of that without like a Japanese, perhaps a Japanese perspective, which I don't have. So that's kind of lost on me. But I don't feel like he's being like put down ish, or he's kind of like, oh, he's kind of like, that's just like not me, you know?
Yeah.
And that's fine to me. Mm-hmm. But of course, I am a foreigner. So, I mean, there's a Japanese context that's lost on me, and that's fine. I'll have to like read up on it. But good point to make.
Yeah, do we want to talk about how, even though this is a Japanese, you know, very culturally Japanese and everything, there is a decent attempt to make it very global and inclusive.
Yeah. So I was really surprised about the way bigger sphere of the African diaspora. So, of course, our main cast is Japanese. We're set in Japan. Nisha, who helps supply the Amars with fabric and for their clothing, she is from India. Ex-husband's Japanese. She just decided to hang around. Kai and Faeyong are from Singapore. I'm not sure if I mentioned this our last podcast, but Kurenosuke is actually biracial.
Yeah, I don't remember this coming up in the last podcast. So I was like, oh, that's
no,
a good
I think,
point.
I think we're just like so blown away about the first. So Kurenosuke is in fact biracial. His father, of course, is Japanese and his mother is Italian. So she's white. Who knows how they met? Like, I guess his dad went to one of her shows.
I mean, yeah, he like went to her shows and was like, she seems cool. And I don't know.
And then they traumatized Shu forever.
Yeah, then they traumatized Shu forever. Exactly.
That was such a bizarre like story. Can we let's just jump at that real quick. So okay. Shu is apparently traumatized by clothing or like high fashion or just the thought of Kurenosuke's mother and like romantic intimacy, because as a child, he walked into Kurenosuke's either her closet room or her dressing room at one of her performance centers or theaters.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking like, oh no, he saw two adults passionately embracing and in an act. And it was like, no, your dad was just like second base. And I'm like,
yeah, she couldn't handle second base walking in on. I'm like, kids have seen far worse than that, Shu. You need to get over that.
You need to get over that, which is why, in part, why he's still virgin to this day. But let me get back to what we were saying. So Kurenosuke is, in fact, biracial. I wanted to make a note about biracial people, their portrayal in manga. I read Hanakimi, which is a shoujo manga. For You in Full Blossom, I guess, would be like the English localization title. It was pushed in from Tokyo Pop, I remember, years ago.
Oh, Tokyo Pop. Those were the days.
Those were the days. So the female protagonist, Nezuki, she's Japanese. She's living in America. Her favorite Japanese track star is a young teenager named Sano. She makes up her mind. This is another gender bender cross-dressing story. She makes up her mind to cut her hair, dress as a boy, and she's going to enter an all-boys boarding school and also do track and meet her hero. A lot of gender bending hilarity happens. But she has an older brother who's actually her half-brother. His mother was white, and of course, their father is Japanese. And when he is finally presented in the manga, he has the very blondish hair, different colored eyes, and people on site think he's like exotic. That's something, right? He pops up on her campus and he's like sparkling and was like, oh, is that a model? Who's that? Foreigner? And I remember in the author's notes, because I was like, that's not how biracial people look generally. Yeah. You know, just me like in middle school and high school, like, and the author did acknowledge and like in her little margin author notes that she was like, yeah, most biracial people don't look like this realistically. This is just like how I'm portraying one in my manga. And I'm like, okay, thanks for acknowledging that. Because Kiranosuke has the blondish hair. And in the anime, at least, he has like the light colored eyes.
Yeah, I mean, Japan and race is very interesting. But yeah, my example to piggyback on that had been Maid-sama has a similar thing where the main male protagonist, Usui Takumi, is half Japanese and half English. And he has blonde hair and green eyes.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like, that's not how genetics work, but okay. It doesn't even make sense within the realm of Maid-sama because he has an older brother who is, you know, the legitimate mm-hmm. English, like, heir mm-hmm. to some castle thing or whatever in England. And he has dark hair. I think he's supposed to have, like, light, like, blue eyes or something. But, like, he totally has dark hair and everything. You're just kind of like, all right, that's genetics. Yeah. Sure. Like, whatever.
that is genetics in the realm of manga. And I'm like, oh, okay. And it's funny you bring up that example because I'm thinking of when Tsukimi, so I'm thinking book 7. Book 7 or book 8. So volumes 13 or 14 or, no, it's 13 or 14. When Tsukimi first comes to Singapore, her translator is also a biracial guy who works for Kai in the company. And he has blonde, hair, possibly blue eyes. I don't know. And yeah, he grew up, he's fluent in Japanese and English and whatnot. And he's also the same type of, you know, lineage. And I'm just like, that's pretty funny. This is a really, it's a very visual way, striking way visually to say, yeah, this person is, you know, biracial. And I'm like, okay. We're doing that here. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like for the most part, Princess Jellyfish's representation of other races is fairly respectful. And I'm really glad that for Kuranosuke, nobody questions whether he's half really throughout it. And I'm like, that is so refreshing, really. Especially going back to Maid-sama as an example, like Maid-sama, I think has very similar themes to Princess Jellyfish in that it's also about like gender and fashion and social class. But the whole main conflict in the second half is about, you know, Usui being half and all the expectations that he has as like a political, you know, family where there's an heir and all these things. And like, that is just like a sore point throughout, you know, the whole thing. And I'm just like, I'm so glad that, you know, Kuranosuke has issues related to being half in that, like, his mother lives in Italy and he doesn't see her and those things. But that's more about, like, the illegitimacy of him and stuff than mm-hmm. him being half. So I'm just, like, really glad that that's not, like, a sore point in his identity, to be honest.
Totally. And it's kind of just interesting to see how race is handled or portrayed in manga by different manga authors in different, you know, in different eras. Because once upon a time, it just, it was lacking. it was lacking.
I mean, there are certainly still stereotypes in how they, like, you know, how we've just been talking. Like, it's like, okay, they are remotely foreigner. So, like, cool, we're gonna just, like, give them really big noses and give them blonde hair and all these things. It's like there's still stereotypes, but like for the most part, I think they're getting more respectful.
Yeah, a bit more progressive, more respectful. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, I think I would like to correct. I think actually Usui's brother is perhaps 3/4 English or something. something like that. He might not be full. Math is hard.
Math is hard.
But still, that's not how genetics work. That's the whole
point. I retook a stats class twice. Math is hard. Yeah. Let's acknowledge it.
Math is hard. Genetics are confusing, but they're not that confusing.
Mm-hmm. So one really, another big theme for this series for me was agency. And I guess to give my own definition with agency is because you hear like, oh, this female character in this Marvel film doesn't have any agency. And people are like, what? A working definition. Yeah. People are like, what? Like, Black Widow.
I know.
Black
I'm like, how?
We got it. Yeah.
Reading this, I was like, I understand that there are people who don't get it still, but also how? But go on.
It's, you know what? It's defined in different ways, but a best working definition that I have, because I study film and television and different, you know, parts of the media industries. Agency is more or less the level of control and the decisions in your life that you have. So in your day-to-day life, it's more like what you can say yes or no to, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So in the series, we think about, oh, who has agency and who has more agency than others? So, for example, in the first half, the Amars have very little. And then Inari Shoto, the property development agent lady.
Yeah.
Who, yeah, she had a whole lot more agency, right, versus the Amars. And also because she was seen more as a woman, you know, in society.
Yes.
But then even with that, her bosses had more agency than her, because when she failed to bring, you know, the apartment complex that the Amars were living in, we find out in the second half, she's in the boondocks trying to put a mall, you know, so yeah. There's different levels of agency. We can argue that all the Amars gained enough agency to start supporting themselves and integrate to society to a better degree. So, I mean, the agency question comes in the terms of, what's Akimi? How much did she have? How much did it impact her with Kurenosuke? With Shu, even, to a much lesser degree, right? Because she's yeah. more still of a background character.
I mean, it's very, like, looking at your questions, I was just like, I don't know that I have clear answers. Because it's so hard, like, you look at Kurenosuke and you're like, oh, he seems like he has tons of agency, but he's just, like, stealing his dad's money, basically, right?
Yeah, like, he has his dad's gold card. He's like, I'm going to buy this.
Yeah, and then just like even with, you know, how you mentioned Inari, it's like, yeah, she seems like she has lots of agency, but like in the end, her whole arc is her chasing around one person to do this one task, which is to get the title deed signed so that they can sell it. And she just like she can't do that, right? Like
she can't get the job done.
Right. And it's like, yeah, Shu seems like Shu has agency that he doesn't know what to do with, I guess, basically, you know?
Which is like the worst, you know? It is the worst. Shu.
And for me personally, I thought about this in terms of like, because, you know, you also wrote that it's about them maturing and like, you know, their parents raising them. Like you think of, you know, you grow up and you become 18 and you slowly become less reliant on your parents. And then you're like 22 or whatever. And you're just an adult now and trying to fend for yourself in the crazy world. But I actually think that their parents played a lot in the role of how much agency they do or do not have as
Hello.
Characters.
Yeah. Hello, enablers.
Enablers, yes. But even like, so like Lena, Kurenosuke's mom, has like, seemingly she's an adult, she has agency, but there's still something preventing her from like seeing Kurenosuke. Like,
yeah, that's not, it never really was super duper duper discussed in
right?
detail.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like a combination of guilt that she left him because of whatever reason she couldn't like handle raising him was the implication. And just like at this point, you know, she doesn't want to like create a political scandal, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Like uproot the child's life and whatnot.
Yeah. And then like, again, Kurenosuke's agency seems outwardly really great, but like in the end, he can't do anything really that he wants on his own. Like he uses his dad's money to buy all his fancy clothes as a way to basically like, that is his rebellion, because he's like, I don't want to be a politician. I'm mad that I can't go see my mom. Like, you won't tell me where she is. I know you know, and I hate you for it and all these things. So he's just like doing everything that he can to try to obtain agency because he knows that he doesn't have it, right? Like, that's basically what Kurenosuke's deal.
That's such a great example. Like, that's such a great realization there. He's like, yo, and even his whole meeting Tsukimi and Amars is on a whim, right? So,
yeah, totally just random. And then, like, Tsukimi again, like, her deal is, you know, sort of she's also has mom troubles, but it's that her mom has died. And I think this is less emphasized in the manga, but, you know, there's certainly, like, that's one of the things holding Tsukimi back, I think, is that, you know, she thinks about her mom a lot and how her mom made this promise to her that one day she would make her a dress that looked like a jellyfish for getting married or whatever. And I think Tsukimi thinks that that's not an attainable thing because she's like, well, my mom's not here anymore. I, like, clearly failed at becoming a princess on my own, so, like, whatever, right? You know? And then most of what Tsukimi ends up doing, like, she certainly gains agency by the end, but, you know, again, she's just kind of following Kurenosuke there for a while and, like, using his dad's money or whatever.
Because even when she's like, oh, I want to go back home and make dresses with my friends for Kurenosuke, that totally changes. She's like, I want to go back home to make dresses with my friends. Let's make dresses for ourselves.
Yeah. And she has very little power to get back home, but that's a different problem.
Hey, all the pieces matter. They got her home. That's what counts.
That's what counts. Good job, Kurenosuke. Yeah, and then we have Shu, who's like, you know, he has his mom and his dad. He doesn't have, like, separation issues, but he definitely certainly has that scar from his dad. And I think there's other, you know, he's basically trying to live up and succeed his dad in politics and all these things. So, like, he's very constrained. But, like, it's a constraint of his own making. Like, he doesn't really have to be this way. It's just what he has chosen because he's kind of like a follower. Any shoe? I don't know.
Any shoe. A mood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, as we see, he's, like, very not well adjusted to society, despite being a politician. And even his dad and his uncle or whatever acknowledge, the uncle that's the PM, acknowledge that they're like, you know, Kurenosuke is the one who actually has the personality to be a politician because he's kind of manipulative and all these things. And Shu is just like too pure-hearted and
he's very
naive.
Vanilla.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
To like be in politics. So like, yeah, we see Shu he's been rolling in money apparently since he was like 16, but he doesn't know what to do with it. So he works in politics and he doesn't know what to do with that power. Like, okay, he uses it at the end to help Tsukimi and Kurenosuke put on the fashion show at an aquarium. Like, that's the extent.
He secures a location, bless his heart. I'm like, come on, Shu, come through. Because there's only so many things you're good for. Sorry.
I know. Shu did this one good thing. But yeah, so Shu is just like a mess in agency.
He is. But, you know, he's, bless his heart, he's a sweetheart that just makes you say, Shu goes overseas to go get an engagement ring for a girl who thinks she hates him and that he broke up with her. Like, what are we doing here?
What are we doing?
Too pure-hearted.
And he made it in the shape of a jellyfish that looked like an octopus.
On brand, like it's very on brand. Like he knows he's a Tsukimi is a jellyfish otaku. He is a Tsukimi otaku, right? So on brand, like the thought is like, yo, that is actually really cute and that's actually really thoughtful. However, you guys are not in that type of relationship where that is, you know, but what have you?
What?
So on the top, I mean, like, what can you do? Like, tell me, like, what was your response when you realized he really went to go get, he really got an engagement ring for Tsukimi? Like,
I mean, I was just like, there's no, I mean, I was still, I thought there was enough evidence that could possibly work out in the end. But I was like, I really don't want it to, right? Like, I am definitely a Kurenosuke and a Tsukimi shipper here.
Same. But I was like, she, I mean, there's more context to it, like how she feels and how she thinks they are. Like, oh, he hates me. And Kurenosuke is like, really? And I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah, Kurenosuke is like, I don't think that's true. I'm going to manipulate you now that you said that. Like,
yeah, like, trying to push this in my favor.
Yeah. I mean, it's a classic example of like, hey, if you guys are going to get, like, I think in his mind, they had already discussed getting engaged because that was kind
in
of
his
the,
mind.
Yeah, that was kind of the setup he had initially given, right? Was like, hey, do you want to date with the intention of getting married?
Intention to marry. Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think that Tsukimi fully understood, right? So, like, it was a classic example of, like, hey, if you're going to propose to somebody, you should probably be, like, you should probably talk about it in some way before asking.
In detail.
Yeah.
In full detail disclosure. Like, yo, marriage entails this.
Yeah, like, are we going to get married? Like, do you want to get married someday? Or, in like, you know, work that out beforehand.
I mean, for those listening, please.
Yeah. And I guess we haven't really touched on, like, Kai's agency, which thinking about it more also has a lot to do with parents or lack thereof.
Yeah, actually, you know, it all ties together. All the pieces matter on this chessboard.
Yeah. Interesting. Because, right, like you would think Kai as a CEO has lots of power. But as we see at the end, he gets dethroned because of economic insecurity in China or whatever. Basically, another company like buys up all the cheap stock because it's fallen a lot. And then they push him out as CEO because they own over 50% of the company or whatever.
And he saw it coming. He predicted it. So he wasn't really surprised, which is why Tsukimiya was like the muse or the lady luck to help revigorate the company or the industry or whatever. But good point.
Yeah. And obviously, like Kai the whole time obviously starts out with not a lot of Kai's story is actually like really, really tragic. If you know, he started off in an orphanage, obviously having very little to no agency, creates his own agency, but like apparently loses his soul in the process. And then like, even when he's super on top, he ends up on the bottom again. It's very sad.
Super, super duper duper lonely at top, right?
Yeah.
Super lonely. Like Faeyoung, I'm not sure if they had like a romantic relationship or just unrequited love, and he's just purposely being ignorant or just like not caring about her feelings. But yeah, like the ball drops a lot faster. He's like, oh, the bubble burst. So he knew this was coming, right?
He's like, oh, that burst faster than I thought it was going to burst.
Yeah, like he is super calm. So like, yeah. And then he like relocates to Japan. I'm like, oh, okay. Because my whole thing was, you know, I was like, okay. They're like, oh, also, we need to talk about that apartment complex. We're going to have to sell it. And he's like, oh, I can go and file it. And I'm like, oh, no, he's going to take Tsukimiya again. Like, what's yeah. happening? Right? My thing was, who owns the complex, their home,
who
and what's
going
to happen to it? Yeah. Basically. There was one thing I wasn't completely sure. So when Faeyoung leaves, she resigns. Mm-hmm. And then Kai doesn't seem remotely surprised at that. She goes back and she's helping out the orphanage she grew up at. And someone donated towels.
Yeah.
And the kids were happy. And she's like, oh, you guys use these old worn towels a lot. And they're like, we're going to throw them away. And she's like, no, we're going to keep them and reuse them for something. Were those towels a gift from Kai? Or am I just reading into?
Oh. I did not think that, but
I was thinking maybe that was kind of like a parting gift. Like, I'm sorry, I'm trash. You're back home to where we were. Hopefully these towels remind you.
Hopefully these towels really help you out.
I mean, yeah, but I was like, where did towels come from? I'm like, they could have just came from anyone. But I felt like that was something Kai would do, but it wasn't. I'm not sure if it was implied, but it wasn't explicitly stated. Like, oh, yeah, these came from, you know, CEO, former CEO.
Yeah. I didn't read it like that, but I like that reading. So now I will.
I mean, it kind of seems like something he would do, because remember the child who got adopted, he went to their wedding because they're all adults now.
Yes.
Like, oh, yeah, it was a picture of him, the kid who got adopted. And he was like, obviously envious of. He's like, oh, yeah, the white shirt. And he's like, oh, I'll send you one. But it was a photo of that kid when they were kids in a little white shirt. So I was like, this seems like something he would do. But I'm happy for Faeyoung. She was like, I'm going to go, you know, simpler days. I'm going to go be a waitress or whatever. And yeah. She ends up at the orphanage where she was, but she's helping. And I'm like, you know what? That's a good ending for Faeyoung, right?
Yeah, as long as I hope she like saved a lot of money when she was at Avidity or whatever it's called, and is just like gonna live the life making like minimum wage but secretly having lots of money.
Yeah, like if she's doing something she likes. That was the whole thing about working for Kai's company. It was sucking the love and like the life out of everyone, right? And then this is something that she knows working at the orphanage will impact someone's life a whole lot more, and she'll probably be happier doing. So, yeah. I mean, Faeyoung, I hope your life is long and happy and full.
I mean,
fresh towels.
It particularly sucked for her at Kai's company because, like, she sees all the parallels of how Kai is treating her, is treating, like, Tsukimiya exactly how Kai used to treat her when she was younger and stuff. Like, clearly Kai has been like, this is my new Faeyoung, and she's like, I'm not
yes.
putting up with this BS.
Right, like, when Kiranose comes to rescue Tsukimi, and he's like going through the floors, like, you know, in Final Fantasy VII, when you're at the Shinra Corporation, and you don't take the elevators, you're going up the stairs. He's like on the struggle bus, and he finally gets to a certain point, and she's like, "No, Tsukimi, everything's fine." And she pretty much allows him to steal away Tsukimi, and I'm like, I respect that, but why?
Agency. So, she's taking it back. That's why.
See, taking it back. Everyone's getting pieces of it and putting it together like Play-Doh and like running away with it. So I appreciate that. Let's see, like, no character is like really one dimensional. Like, everyone is like layered to a certain extent.
Yeah. So do we want to talk about ships?
Ships. Yes. Whose ship is sailing into the horizon?
Yeah. Well, the first one I wrote down was the obviously joke couple, but still, Hanamori x Nisha. We haven't talked about these two, so we need to talk about them, obviously.
So these were really two fun side characters in the main cast. Hanamori, of course, is the Mercedes-Benz loving driver for the Kubachi family. And then Nisha is, I guess, the dealer, the clothing dealer, or the cloth dealer, fabric dealer, that the Amars talk to and deal with and talk in confidence with. And they're really, like, just two really fun characters. Like, they're just, like, really odd or weird, but in a sense that, I mean, they have a better chance of, like, walking, you know, down the street in society and, like, not turning to stone, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a joke. You know, a joke couple, but it's like Hanamori loves Mercedes-Benz too much. Like, he loves it almost as much as breathing air. And Anisha is like, she loves like being caught up in the middle of stuff and is having a good laugh. But they're like two fun characters. Like, there could be more, but they, of course, play like really important parts in the plot and the narrative and getting the ball rolling, right? Hanamori is driving everyone everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
And he's blabbing all the details when he's not supposed to.
Yes. Characters learn very important things about other characters via Hanamori.
Yeah, like, that's his purpose, right? It's like some comic relief, but also, oh, yeah, Kiranosuke's a man.
What?
I'm like, oh, it had to come out sometime.
Yeah, right. And then Nisha has the really powerful scene at the end with the Amars when they've decided that they're like, how can we make clothes when we don't understand clothes? So we're going to invest in ourselves first, and we're going to go to this department store and buy fancy clothes. And she tries to help them by being like, hey, okay, I'll take you so you don't just petrify and run away and whatever. It's not like a super successful trip, but she was, you know, relatively patient with them for Nisha.
Yes, she was. For her level, it was like she did what she could do. But it worked for Gigi, at least. And that kind of spread.
I know. I secretly really love Gigi. Like,
I mean,
my favorite Amar.
She's really the most quiet one, like background. Like, she's perhaps really the most background one because she's so quiet and soft spoken. But, oh, goodness, like, she really put in work.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. But then, so Hanamori and Nisha, they don't have, like, that many scenes together, I guess. I did enjoy when Hanamori is like, can I have $1,000 or whatever to go make it into $100,000 at a casino in Singapore? And she's just like, sure. And all the Amars are like, what? How could you give him so much money? And she's like, it's okay. He's just like my pet idiot. It's fine. I just do these
and she's
things.
Like, women like me have like three or four of them. Like,
yeah.
Okay. I mean, their scenes together, you know, we talk about like comic relief and like the buddy-buddy system. So for the Amars, Mayaya and Banba, when they get together, it's like, oh, this is something I look forward to reading. When Hanamori and Nisha get together and like go on a date with Tsukimi and Shu or go on a trip together, like a local trip, not like overseas trip, it's fun to read. That's a good like buddy cop thing to read.
I appreciate them, yes, as characters. I don't, they're obviously not a real couple, but, you know, I appreciate everything that they do as a couple. Next couple that I had written down was Kai and Feiyang.
Crash and burn.
Crash and burn.
I mean,
Kai.
Look, not everyone is for you. It was kind of heartbreaking to watch because when Kai and Feiyang first come in the scene, before we get a lot of their origin story, we don't know their relationship. Like, okay, well, this is his secretary. But when we get to Singapore and Kai takes Tsukimi to the curry place that he first took Fei Young to when they make enough money. And he's like, oh, she's like, the fish here at the orphanage isn't that good. He takes her. He's like, I know a place you can eat good for $6. And of course, $6 doesn't seem like a lot of money. It is to me in different parts of the world, right? In different parts of the world, money has, you know, it's a currency that changes and it means certain things. It means, you know, it's mobility. It means different things to different people. He takes her to the curry places, like in the cut, like not shabby, but it's like this not luxury food restaurant place. Mm-hmm. And to eat curry. And when Fei Young finds out that Kai took Tsukimi there to no fault of Tsukimi, and she was like done. She was
wow, you finally betrayed me for real, Kai. You're like, you've done a lot, but this is the breaking point.
This is the nail in the coffin. Yeah. So my thing was, even if you don't read Kai and Fei Young as previously having a romantic relationship, or if they're just two kids who grew up together and they're super close and it's unrequited love, or, you know, Kai is just being like a trash dude, but like not being considerate of like, hey, this is, I'm basically replacing my best friend from childhood. It's just really a significant relationship to pay attention to. And it was really hurtful. It was really hurtful for Fei Young to be like, because she knew Kiki and she knew like the models, but Tsukimi is like, oh, I'm being replaced. No, that hurt me. I was like, oh.
I know.
Fei Young.
I know. And the only reason I read them as having a romantic relationship is because when they went to the wedding for the chubby kid who was at the orphanage with them, who got adopted before them or whatever, there's the one dude who's like, oh, are you still with Fei Young? And I guess he could have meant like, you know, are you still friends? But it felt like wording of a romantic relationship. So that's why that's the only reason. Otherwise, we never actually see them have romance in the past or in the present.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it was just like implied that they were together or they were together romantically in the past as adults, or kind of just were kind of an open relationship or whatever. But that's actually one way to read it.
I guess we could also discuss Kai and Tsukimi, since that was a thing for a hot second.
You know what? The volume we had where he takes Tsukimi swimming with one of his, you know, the blonde, the half guy. And he like, oh, Tsukimi, let's change the world. He kisses her in the water. I was like, wait a minute. This is a ship I did not see coming. I don't want this. This complicates everything way too much. Yeah, I was kind of like, nope. And it was like a cliffhanger, like not after that kiss, but that was the rest of that volume ended not too soon. Like Kiranosuke came to Singapore right after that. So I was like, oh, I got to wait another, you know, month or so, couple months for the next volume. I was like, what?
See, I'm going to be real. Like, I was kind of like, oh, what's going to happen? There was a point where I skimmed ahead. Like, I just flipped through ahead. So I saw Kai. I had no idea who Kai was, right? And I was just like, oh, no. Is there another guy who comes in? My heart can't handle that. Like, oh, snap.
Can't do it.
I just can't even. And, like, there was a moment where Tsukimi, like, when they were getting curry and stuff, like, she seemed to be like, oh, maybe Kai isn't so bad. And I was like, no, I can't take this.
My sweet summer child, guard your loins. Like, she's like, oh, when he laughs, he crinkles. Like, he's a very, like, eccentric dude, but very calculating dude. But she was like, oh, maybe he's a good person after all. Like, maybe I'm just, like, judging him too hard. I'm just like, stay away from our sweet summer child.
I know.
Do not kiss her. Do not pass go. Go straight to jail. Like, we're also protective of her. It's like, nope.
Yeah. Nope. No. No, Kai. Get out. Can't handle this. Definitely. So I definitely cheated by not having to wait for volumes, because I was just like, oh, no, there's a third dude. I can't take that. But truly, there are only two real dudes, and they are the Koibuchi brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So Shu and Tsukimi, true feelings about that.
It's there. Like, you ever see like a something in your home is like, oh yeah, it's there. Like, okay.
I actually really, okay, I came around on Shu before he went to Italy and bought a ring.
Yeah, like, it was plausible then. It was like, okay, this could possibly work. Yeah.
Right? Like, he had a solid volume where I was like, oh, Shu, you've made me fall in love with you too. Damn it, Shu. I've never been so torn up about a love triangle in my damn life. And there are so many love triangles. How dare you, Shu?
Yeah, like, he was a strong contender for a while, because especially because their feelings were mutual, right? Tsukimi's like, yeah, I want to go out and see Shu, and Shu's like, I want to go out and see Tsukimi. Like, it was like mutual. Mm. Like, they would like blush and do that weird, you know, like it was mutual. So I'm like, this could possibly work.
Yeah.
Then we had the monkey wrench, which was Kiranosuke.
Yeah.
Knowing that Tsukimi's important to him, not trying to acknowledge it, and like just being a monkey wrench to Tsukimi and Shu's relationship. So. Yeah, but Shu was a strong contender. Yeah. In the end, I didn't think he was good for her because they're too much alike. Like, they don't challenge each other, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, versus where with the ship that we're all, the OTP, right?
Obviously.
Of Kiranosuke and Tsukimi, like, they challenge each other. I think on service, you'd be like, oh, there's two different, right? She's obviously an introvert and he's an extrovert, but they challenge each other, and they, over the course of this entire manga, they forced each other to grow up a bit and like consider things outside their comfort zone and all that. But like I said, last podcast, they're very, very much alike. You know, the whole connection with their mother and just being very sensitive souls, like sweethearts. But so, you know, but I'm glad that this was Endgame, because I saw this as Endgame. And I'm glad that their relationship evolved to a point where Tsukimi saw Kiranosuke as the princess, right?
Yeah.
As, I want to make dresses for him with my friends, too. I want to make dresses for my friends and myself. Also, Kiranosuke is there at the end, in my dreams, or where I see us. And he finally acknowledges his feelings. He's like, I love you, Tsukimi. And she's like, what?
She actually handled it very well for Tsukimi, I think, you know?
Because I think she realized, hey, I do love him in some sense, right? Regard as well. To in a way that's more honest and like natural, right?
Yeah, I think there's definitely, I love that, you know, in the end, Kiranosuke is the one who's really vulnerable and not Tsukimi. You would think Tsukimi would be petrified as soon as Kiranosuke is like, hey, I love you. Let's run out on the stage now. But, you know, in the end, Kiranosuke is like, hey, I know you might not like need a dude right now. Maybe you don't see me as like a potential lover right now, but like I need you. So, hey, I'm gonna live with you. And she's like, that's cool. Whatever, bro. And I was like, oh, just hug. You're dancing together. I love you.
Like the ending, I really loved the ending. And I mean, I suppose there are some readers be like, I didn't like that. I think there's a lot of surprises that came with the ending.
Really? But, people didn't like that?
I'm assuming, because I'm like, I like something. I'm pretty sure there's someone in the world who doesn't like
it. Well,
like.
Yeah, that's, okay.
Right? But how this series ended, I liked it. There were surprises. It was enough closure for me. I'm on the last page when they're at the apartment complex. Everyone's having fun and dancing. And so the prince and the princess lived happily ever after in the castle. You want to know if they got married. There's no need to get hung up on forms and institutions, are there? This is a neo-princess story for the 21st century. As long as there's love, it's all good. So again, it's reinforcing that we're making our own path in the world. For the Amars, who have been outsiders in society, like they didn't go to college, didn't go to school, career, didn't get married, all these like milestones, I guess, the Amars are doing anything different. So Tsukimi and Kiranosuke's relationship is like they have love for each other and they're going to do what they love, which is making the dresses and being with their friends, which also are Kiranosuke's friends now, right?
Yes.
he's been around long enough.
He's like, I love you all. Still be friends with me, even though I'm a dude.
Like, yeah, two of us knew this already, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I like that how there's no labels, like the institutions that define us in society can also bind us or like, you know, make us. Yeah. So yeah. I love how this ended, especially for them.
Yeah. No, I was seriously afraid that nobody would end up with anybody, to be honest.
I'm like, well, you know what? The series was hinting at that. Beginning of beginning of book 9, which is the last volume, 17th volume, Kirinosuke and Shu are in the beginning, and Kirinosuke is like, wouldn't it be nice if we just all lived, the three of us lived together? And I was like, polyamorous relationship?
Yeah, polyamorous, like, go for it.
Yo, and he's like, you know, independent of marriage or, like, love. And Kirinosuke is like, what? And he's like, oh, I'm just kidding. But she was kind of like, look, I want to live around Tsukimi, and Tsukimi wants to live around you, so
yes.
Like, I know him, but that's not...
Well, I thought it more because there's also a moment where Kirinosuke is like, you know, maybe Tsukimi eventually will choose one of us, or maybe she'll choose neither of us. And I was like, don't put that seed in her mind, Kirinosuke. How dare you?
I mean, look, first and foremost, like I said last podcast, I ship Tsukimi with love, self-love and validation and what she wants out of life. But this ship was endgame, Tsukimi and Kirinosuke. But that was a very valid point for a male character to make.
It's true.
Look, dudes have pride, like, she's going to choose me. No, she's going to choose me. It's Kirinosuke who's in touch with his femininity and his feminine side. Like, look, like, he's grown up too. He'd be like, look, she may choose none of us and we'll have to be okay with that. And I'm like, look at you.
I know. Look at you, Kirinosuke.
Right? Being vulnerable, but also like, look, it is her choice, right? She didn't have to end up with anybody, and that's perfectly fine too.
But it's exactly those types of sentiments that make you love Kirinosuke.
Yeah, like, look who grew up, right? Yeah. Look who grew up. I appreciate that. I really did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Tsukimi and Shu, like, when they were, seemed like a good thing. It was kind of because they were, like, in isolation there for maybe a volume where, you know, Shu was like, I got you this permit to do this protest so that you guys are okay. And he, like, helped with something at the sweet shop with their, like, well or whatever. And so, like, he just did a bunch of things, but Kirinosuke wasn't there, right, for most of them, I feel. So then I just like that, you know, in the end, Tsukimi has a moment where she's like, Shu can't possibly be falling in love with me. Is this some sort of, like, why are people trying to help me get with him or whatever? Is this some sort of assassination plot to, like, keep me away from Shu? And the only person she can tell about that is Kirinosuke, because Kirinosuke is the only one who, like... accepts that sort of, like, nonsense, not, and doesn't, like, dismiss it, and, like, understands Tsukimi's brain, sort of. And I was like, see, you're running to Kirinosuke because he's your one true love.
I mean, like, it's leading you, but she was doing all the right things, you know, for someone you love. You go out over and beyond.
Yeah.
But even like friendship wise, when you have a friend and it's not like a toxic relationship, you know, you do things and you check in and you look after people you care about, which is a perfect way to our next segue, how there's different types of love, right?
Yeah.
We have, of course, which might be the most significant because it's what shapes our most of our main cast, the love of fandoms. Love of whatever makes you an otaku. This comes first because the Amars, and we find out that everyone is an otaku, right?
Yeah.
In some greater sense of the world, you know? March Madness, basketball otaku, jellyfish otaku, manga, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have the love of your friends, of community, of sisterhood, of the Amars. That I love. I've always loved reading stories about girls and women supporting and being around other girls and women, because it's a feel good, you know, and it's something that you just need to see if you are in fact a girl and or a woman, right?
Yes, so, definitely.
So the Amars binding together to, like, do the work and, like, get it done. And then there's, of course, romantic love, idealized and not. So you have whatever is in Shu's head, his grand schemes of romance, Shu, right? And then, like, romantic love in a sense that I'm in love with someone who I've been standing next to this whole time and running after, and she has helped change me and be a better person or a better man with Kirinosuke, with Tsukimi. So it's important to remember and acknowledge all these different levels and types of love. They all play a part in the story. And then there's, like, Hannah Mori, love of Mercedes-Benz, right? So
yeah, one true love, Mercedes-Benz.
I mean, it's one true love. That's the only thing he can draw. Gosh, so many funny scenes and panels with him. He's such a cool guy.
Sometimes you're kind of like, objectively, he's definitely not a cool guy. Like,
totally.
But, like, he's funny and, like, so, like, harmless enough for that humor to work on him. So
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I'm just like, where did you guys find this guy at? How did he come to be? I wish in all the little origin stories that were left in these later volumes,
Snap. Yes, that would have been so much better.
I really wish that we could have got the origin story, even just a few pages, like they found him sleeping in their Mercedes Benzes like one night. I don't know, like, yeah. See, that's something that would have took like 5 minutes to draw and execute. But I wish we could have got his little origin story.
Yeah, because actually, like, I don't know, I found the origin stories like kind of the weakest points of this. Like, I was like, okay, I mean, I don't feel like I, you know, gained that much more insight into those characters from those origin stories, but like a Hanamori origin story would have just been hilarious. Like,
it would have been wild. Like, I wasn't expecting this. Thanks.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Like, it kind of like the other origin stories, it's like, yeah, okay, I get it. But like Hanamori, I'm like, there's so many things that you could blow my mind with that. Like, please have done that.
Because with Hanamori, it could just be so like outlandish and wild, it would work.
Yeah.
You know?
Whereas the other ones had to be somewhat reserved, and it was kind of like, okay, like, yeah.
I at least wished with the Amars, how they came to be, it was expanded on a bit much. Because we have Banba and Mayaya and Chaco. Yeah, so like a few, but we didn't get how Gigi came to be and how Tsukimi, more importantly, which I guess I want to leave some mystery, some allure. And I'm like, oh, okay. But I was like, Mayaya, like her, is this. She is too big and bold to be left in the background, because how she comes to be, I'm just like, wow, your parents enabled you, like something.
Yeah, yeah. Your dad enabled you, apparently.
Like the most severe example of like not functioning in society. This is it. Goodness. But yeah, I'm like, how did Tsukimi come about? And I'm like, well, I guess that's not a very important story, an important part of the origin story, because Tsukimi's such a big focus of the series. But I'm like, okay, I guess. That Hanamori story would have been great, though. Just saying.
Please give me that. But yeah, I guess one of the big reveals at the end was about Meijiro Sensei, or son.
Wow.
Who
saw that coming, Ashley? Who?
I definitely did not. I'm gonna be real.
My goodness.
I mean, it all makes sense now, but so in the end, it's revealed that the manga artist who hides in the room and nobody has seen the entire time, and who declares things from on high, like that no boys are allowed in Amamizukan, turns out that person actually is a man, and that they went to the first fashion show as well, and then they would go to the second one, and they bring Clara along, the jellyfish that Tsukimi owns, and yeah.
What a shock. Ooh, I mean, this is when I'm surprised. You're like, wow, I am shooketh. I am shooketh to the highest degree. Like, who? We didn't, you know, there's this really fantastic scene. So in the last volume, volume 9, book 9, volume 17, sorry, clarification.
It's so hard.
Before the final episode, so ending at page 100, it is Clara. The chapter or the little pages are from the perspective of Clara. And she's like, oh, you know, you humans have it rough. You guys fall in love and fail and burn and struggle. And it's all, but it's also, you guys do more than what I do. And it's also very fun. And Clara is talking to Meijiro Sensei, and it's like, oh, hey, I'm going to take you with me. It's like, oh, hi. And we find out that this manga artist that's been living with them has gone to the first fashion show and has peeked around and knows what's up. And we're like, cool, this is a mystery we're going to have unraveled.
Yeah.
I mean, and we see long hair, so I guess we're just assuming, hey, it's a lady, right? And then we get to the fashion show, and Kai's like, bravo, Tsukimi. And someone's like, bravo. And we see Clara in the little... It's like a little jar, almost.
It's like a tiny fishbowl, yeah.
Yeah, with a little lid on it. So I'm just like, is Clara a snack? No.
No.
And the reveal, Hanamori with his deadpan voice is like, yes.
This is
a dude, right?
This is a dude who is Meijiro Sensei.
And we're all kind of just blown away. We're like, okay.
Yes. And then
that happened.
I immediately ship Meijiro and Hanamori as a joke couple, since the mangaka like draws boys love comics all the time. I'm like, clearly they're meant to be, right? Like, Hanamori had previously admitted that he finds Kuranosuke attractive, perhaps only when he dresses up as lady clothes. But you know, that's, I'm just saying.
I mean, I feel like if Majuro Sensei wants to go out into the world more often, that would be like a fun, like another buddy-buddy like couple to have.
Yeah.
You know? that would be some more like just really,
really silly good nonsense. Humor. Yeah.
Yeah, because Majuro Sensei still used to like, you know, putting words in a paper and putting on a door, holding them up. And Hanamori would be like, also, we're out of gas. Like, you know, just... It would make for fun. It would make for good fun. I just if I could just talk about the ending, mm-hmm. You find the page. Boop, doop, boop, boop, doop. The very ending. So the manga ends that we're back at the apartment complex and we have this wonderful party and this new crew of people who are going to live there. And it's Claire speaking as narration. You know, we're like, yo, this is a neo princess story for the 21st century. Take it from Claire. As long as there's love, it's all good. And there you have it, everyone. Thank you so much. Take care. Hope you keep being true to the things you love. More free and more beautiful than anyone else. The final page is this beautiful shot of the ocean. It's green tones, so you know there's like blue skies and clouds. To the world's jellyfish princesses with love. So Princess Jellyfish is a sort of love letter. This manga, entire manga series is a sort of love letter to jellyfish princesses. And if we think of the jellyfish princesses as the Amars, as otaku girls and women, as of anyone who is different, as an outsider, marginalized, weird, this is a really heartfelt like offering, like, hey, you're valid and you are loved and there's something for you in this world. If that's just like the interpretation off the top of my head. I just really enjoyed the series and how it just ended, like especially the last page. I'm like, I respect that.
Yeah, no, it's a really perfect ending. Like, it's not, you know, there's no like unrealistic fantasy nonsense that happens in it, and all these things. And yeah, I think Higashimura in general is really good at writing just like love letters to otaku girls, which is sort of funny because I definitely looked up a lot of pictures of Higashimura because she's actually a very attractive lady. And then I like,
yeah, she's fine. She's like super pretty.
I know. And so I like showed it to my one friend who's also super into Princess Jellyfish. And I don't think he knew what she looked like. And he was like, how does she understand like what weird, like quote unquote unpretty and like or ugly Fujoshi like go through so well? And I was like, well, I mean, she's still a nerd, but she's just a pretty nerd.
Yeah, like, look, we are all otaku. Let's like keep reaffirming that. I was like, oh, not only is she otaku, she's a stylish otaku.
I know.
Because in her author, you know, sometimes we think of like manga authors. For example, for a lot of manga I've read most of my life, in the margins or the author notes, the manga authors always draw themselves as like the form little creatures or little
yes.
stick figures. Or, right? So it's like, I do this amazing job creating stories, right? But also I'm just like this weirdo person who I'm sitting down half the day cranking out this stuff. And I mean, she plays against the stereotypes because like in her author notes, she's always wearing her sweatsuit and she always looks haggard. She's like, I'm so tired. I'm a single mom. I've been sitting over here, you know, like,
yeah.
So it's this wonderful like play on the stereotype. She's a stylist. She's really pretty. She's really into fashion, apparently. And I'm just like, this is cool. Thank you for including all this, you know, interview and like back matter and back page matter. And I'm like, it's a really eye opener. And I'm glad they included it for the American or North American audiences outside of Japan.
Yeah. I mean, even pictures of her when she's actually like in her sweatsuit as, you know, like actual pictures of her. I'm like, your sweatsuit is stylish. You be quiet. It's so
you be quiet.
Good.
Your give up on life pants are fine.
Yeah. Like, oh my God. It's so good. So we should all aspire to be Higashimura. That's basically what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And I know that you had other thoughts about, the end notes of Higashimura, so.
So in book seven, volumes 13 and 14, one of her stories in her author notes, she has a brief story how she met the man who became her second husband. So background information, she was married, she got divorced, and she was a single mom for a while with a young child. apparently her manga studio is just a place that people kind of come in and out of. So she didn't think very highly of this dude. He was a stylist. He was a clothing designer who currently was, or at the time, was making like a line for children. So he just had samples and he would bring them by her studio and she'd work and he'd frequent her studio occasionally. So when the Princess Jellyfish anime was airing, you know, they do promos and stuff. So one of the voice actors was going to be at an event or like recording something or like promoting something. And this guy, he's like, oh my gosh, please let me come to like the place and meet him or just like be around. And she's like, oh my God, this jerk is an otaku. Which was hilarious, right? She's like, he's a stylist, but he's an otaku.
Yeah.
Surprise! We exist, right? They exist. So they ended up bonding over anime and they ended up getting married, right? It was like really funny. So shout out to her. She did marry a stylish younger man who was an otaku, right?
Because she's also a stylist. She's just trying to make us play like she's not.
She's not. Like, I see the lies. Like, I see behind this. Ashley was just so fortunate to burst my bubble.
I didn't mean to burst your bubble. I just want to facts.
Yeah, no, all the facts matter. So my whole thing was, I'm gonna share the story because there's someone for everyone. There's an otaku for, I guess, everyone, right, in this world. Ashley was like, yeah, well, they're divorced now.
Yeah, but it was an amicable divorce. Like,
it so was
good.
And you know, that's nice to have in today's world. What made me think about it a little more in detail, we don't often talk about women's work and the impact our work has on our family. I was reading an article you linked me from Anime Network about how the author revealed her divorce. And she was saying, oh, our work schedules are really, you know, they're not meshing together.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens, you know, when you're married and you have a kid. And yeah, I was thinking about how we think about work and women's work, how do I say this? In society, usually the woman's work isn't valued or isn't presented as most important. I have a friend who's a filmmaker and he's like, oh, well, you know, George Lucas, he took a long time between making movies because he wanted to raise his family, because he did the first trilogy of Star Wars movies. I mean, he had a really crappy relationship with his kids because he wasn't around. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that is acceptable for men. For women, it's like, no, you have to be around to raise your kid, you know, when they, you know, until they go to kindergarten. And then you have to be around. So like female artists, there's a bigger pressure for them society wise because of their gender. Like, they need to be around the kids. They need to be raising the kids. They need to be more involved than the men. Whereas men, male artists, they're free to go do a trilogy of movies or to be filming for a year and a half. So I was thinking about that. I'm like, is there hope? Or I'd like to study more female manga artists, right, who have kids and who are married or have long-term relationships or domestic partnerships. And how does that work? I was really curious. And now I want to go look that up because I never really looked into female manga artists. And there's obviously a whole industry of them who are married.
Yeah.
And, you know, and talk about that, right?
Yeah. I feel like they normally don't talk about that, or I just assume that they're not in a relationship, or if they're in a relationship, they don't have kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, no, Higashimura is also like very forthcoming in her notes about like how much her kid hangs around, you know, her assistants and everything, and how like different people entertain him throughout the day and whatever.
It takes a village. It takes a village. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm like, that's fun. Yeah. And then there was one thing that Higashimura, at the very end, I guess, in book 9, the last volume after volume 17, Higashimura like acknowledges that Princess Jellyfish is apparently more popular in America than she would have expected. It was included on, you know, like best of lists and stuff. And so she like asks her editor, like, why is Princess Jellyfish so popular in America? And they answered, I don't know. I have no clue. Do we have a clue, Carrie? Like, we're Americans. We like Princess Jellyfish.
I totally have a clue. I think that even though, because manga and anime and like video games, of course, right, are products are usually like Japanese products that go all around the world and are super popular, there's only like a certain genre or just like certain things that pop out. Like, for example, like Sailor Moon is still like super important, like shonen, manga and anime, My Hero Academia, Naruto, Dragon Ball, all any form of Dragon Ball, Dragon Ball Z is still like super like boom, like it's recognizable on the street, like Mickey Mouse or like whatever, you know, or maybe even The Simpsons, like around the world. I think she was like, yo, this is like a slice of life manga that's not really for the general audience. Like, it's for a niche audience, right? It's for Jose readers. There is this wonderful article I found online. So it's on the Publisher Weekly website. It is, the title is A Golden Age for Western Manga, Manga Publishers Embrace Steady Growth and New Hits. It's by Deb Aoki. It was published June 1st, 2018. So I found this on Twitter and I retweeted and I read through it and I'm like, hey, this really works. So we're talking about how there's this boom in manga, which is surprising the industry. And they're like, there was a note like, yeah, there's a lot of Jose titles that are picking up steam. And I'm like, of course, because there's a lot of older, right, readers.
But yeah, like we grew up reading shoujo manga and now we're transitioning to Jose is sort of the deal. Yeah,
sort of the deal. So there was a quote I pulled that I tried to like quote tweet, but it was just too long for the 200.
Yeah, 280 characters just isn't enough.
Yeah, I was like, I'm just 14 characters short. So the quote is, the manga industry in Japan is famously known for producing comics for almost any kind of reader. And we're seeing a little more of that in the Western market as the audience ages. We now see an entire generation of Western kids who have had access to manga in English since their childhood. So that is me, yes. And that is you.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically the millennial crowd. And the millennials can be as old as like 40 or 40-ish, right? The age changes depending on who you're talking to. But I had at one point of time as a teenager, 400 volumes of manga, right? So having manga in English, that was like Tokyo Pop's golden days before the market kind of crashed, right?
Before the 2008 recession.
Gosh, got real bad. So much happens, you know? So there's the kids who grew up with manga and they grew up. And of course, we're all still like reading shonen or watching or having some type of connection to like shonen titles, of course. But then like, if you read shoujo growing up, we're kind of like aging out to 30-ish.
Yeah.
Right. And then we want something that kind of reflects our interests. But back to her question, why is Princess Jellyfish itself so popular in America? It's just a really good series. It is relatable. Jellyfish girls are everywhere. Yeah. So, I mean, the content in the manga is relatable and can reach different shores in different countries, which I hope she realizes that. Because she's saying one of her editors came to America for something and they saw Princess Jellyfish cosplay. And she's like, oh, snap.
Yeah. Like, whoa, I didn't expect that.
Yeah. So when you have a good story, good narrative, it can travel and change and be in people's hearts, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, I think it's still very interesting. Like my limited, I mean, I don't work in manga, but my boyfriend does. My limited understanding of that is that, you know, Japanese manga artists are still primarily publishing, like it gets published around the world, but they're still obviously making it for a Japanese audience. And as we discussed earlier, there are plenty of things in this that like feel very Japanese, like culturally specific and stuff. But yeah, I think there's always an underestimation in a manga author's mind about how like global something can be. And yeah, just generally Princess Jellyfish is like, the art is amazing, first, like just straight up amazing. And I think, you know, in this moment of, you know, gender fluidity and LGBTQ rights becoming a bigger and bigger thing, it doesn't surprise me that it would be added to a bunch of lists for like best things to read for teens and whatever. I think that's the one she referenced was like 50 best titles for teens from like a library or something. So it doesn't surprise me that it would be added onto like inclusivity lists and things like that. Gashimura, don't underestimate.
don't underestimate. And I would if there's some one thing I have to tell her if I could, don't underestimate your work because, you know, it's good. It's I mean, for lack of better adjectives, it's really good. And the world will always need stories about girls and women. Like my background in comics is that I grew up, and I grew up on Western comics. So Marvel and DC, the capes, you know, superhero comics. And then I kind of fell into manga. And while I still read, you know, Western comics and Kickstarter comics and web comics are all different industries and you know, levels, manga and stories about girls and women, because, you know, in Japan, manga artists are like revered. If you do comics, you're kind of revered. You're still kind of weird.
You're still a weirdo, but it's much more culturally acceptable to read comics in Japan than in America still, I feel. It's changing slowly in America, but
it's changing. But, you know, stories about girls and women will always be important because there's always girls and women who want stories about them. And it's just, this is a terrific series. And I'm so glad. Like, I remember when Princess Jellyfish, when it finally got published, it made a big splash. They had like a lot of pre-orders. I don't have any numbers in front of me, but a lot of people were buying it because it had been a long time coming. Like, I had read some manga scans. And of course, you guys do this legally now. Like,
It's
available legally. So you can, you know, go to Comixology and get like the digital chapters. But, you know, I'd read a couple, chapters, manga scans a while ago, like years ago. And I was like, this will never be in America. I'm so sad. And Princess Jellyfish had a fan base in America, at least, before it got published legally. Mm. No one talks about this, but it did.
Yeah.
And I guess I was a part of that fan base.
Clearly you were.
You know, the jumping part, the jump off part is that it finally made its way, got picked up. And I mean, kudos to Kodansha for publishing it in two volumes in one to keep people's interest and to kind of like speed up the publishing, like the, hey, we're going to put out this here and this here and this volume here. It just really worked. It really worked. I know manga was like risky for a while. Like, I don't know if we'll buy the rights because this isn't like Sailor Moon or it isn't like an established moneymaker, you know?
Yeah.
And it translated very well. And it is a top seller. Like, people love this manga as they should.
I mean, yeah, I could see how Kodansha would be afraid of getting this, especially since, like, you know, there are so many, especially with Mayaya and stuff, like so many specific things that are not super popular, or like even Bamba being like a train otaku. Like, I guess there are people who like trains in America, but it's definitely different in Japan, you know, and stuff like that. Mm. So like, I can see them being slightly afraid of that. But I think Kodansha, yes, kudos Kodansha, because I feel like they've certainly been bringing over a lot of, they seem like they're doing some risky stuff. They're bringing over a lot of titles. They're doing their digital first initiative. So they're like publishing a ton of shoujo and jose things, at least digitally. And good on you, Kodansha.
It's paying off. It's paying off. Because people are like, oh, people are buying a lot of manga now. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
Because those kids who had, you know, disposable income, right? Their parents' money to buy those 400 volumes of manga I had at one point in time, right? As a kid.
That's a lot of manga.
Man.
For children.
That was one point in time, right? So like, now that we're all like adults and we can, buying manga might be a luxury, but we'll still buy it. But we have maybe more some agency to have.
Yeah, disposable
income. Or credit cards. So it's a cool thing to see that this is a series that finally got here to us. And it's been a treat to read through. And just, of course, you've already had a podcast. A podcast or two? I think one.
It was one.
On Tokyo Terra Riba Girls.
Mm-hmm. Which is also very good.
I mean, there's the first chapter at the end of the final volume of Princess Jellyfish. And I'm like, you guys read this.
Yeah, no, it's very good. Read all the Higashimura things. Any Higashimura title that comes out in English, just buy it immediately. Just don't think about it.
Yeah, and we're in an age that we're getting globalization, that we're getting accessibility to more manga. And they're like reprinting older manga. And it's like, yo, this is a time to be alive and read it and buy it and talk about it so we get more of it. So kudos.
I know. We're back in the golden age, y'all. Don't, like, a crash will probably come again, you know. Be wary. Be happy now.
Mm-hmm. Be happy now and buy it up and hoard it and keep it to yourself.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess those are all our thoughts on Princess Jellyfish. There are a lot of thoughts because it's very good and everybody should read it.
Everyone should read. We keep talking. We keep like going back, but just everyone should read this series. It is too good to miss. Too good to keep up.
It's true.
Thanks for listening to Shoujo and Tell. Comments, questions, constructive criticism, concerns, need a gush about your OTP? Email shoujoandtell@gmail.com or leave a comment on shoujoandtell.com/princessjellyfish2. We're at Shoujo and Tell on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Carrie, where can people find you on the internet and your work?
Hi, you can find me on Twitter mostly, talking about memes and comics and feminism and like random wrestling gifs if you're into that. You can find me on Twitter as Divine Black Pearl, DiVineBlackPearl, Divine Black Pearl on Twitter.
Are you excited every time you see a new episode from us? If so, please consider leaving a rating on iTunes or Stitcher. This will help the podcast reach more hearts, or at least ears. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back next time for Pre-Tier, which is really just an alternative take on Hayate the Combat Battler. It's really not, but actually it's just another take on Cinderella. Or is it Snow White? You'll have to find out in the next episode. Until then, bye!
Bye!